Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 8th, 2016, the Cling Tightly to One Tiny Piece of Good News edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine joins me from New York. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. Sorry for being late. Thank you both for being so nice and patient with me.
I visited your office yesterday, Emily, at the New York Times. I just dropped by because I was in the Times building and quelled with your colleagues about you for a bit. So they're very fond of you.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That's nice. I'm sorry I missed you.
For what purpose did the gentleman go to the New York Times?
Oh, New York Times is an investor in Atlas Obscura. So I was just meeting with the people who invested in us. I had a few minutes to kill, and so I stopped by to see the Times Magazine. That was, of course, John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation, who was in Boston today, apparently. Hello, John.
Hi. Yeah, I'm in Boston. I did something at the Kennedy Library last night, which was a joy, and it's the first time I'd ever been there. It's very cool.
Oh, yeah, that's a cool building. We were just discussing before we started the show whether we should have an advice podcast, a dating advice podcast. So if you think we should.
And we decided the answer was no.
If you think we should, please let us know.
No, we should not.
I mean, could you think of a. I'm trying to think of a podcast that we would have less standing. Like, I think a car repair
ballet.
Podcast might be.
A car repair. Right. Car repair would be worse. Yeah, that's true.
I wouldn't have nothing to say on car repair. Anyway.
okay.
I
wouldn't have nothing to say. What a stag
well,
endorsement.
But I mean, wouldn't people assume?
You have dating advice, John. You were just giving even the pre-show buildup. You were giving
that's
your dating
true.
Advice. So you that's clearly
true.
Have a
I know,
lot
but
to say
people
about
would,
that.
Right. But people would assume that we would actually have absolutely nothing to say about car repair.
You just had to stick up for yourself. You know how to change a tire.
Yeah, exactly.
On this week's GabFest. Dating advice. On this week's GabFest, Donald Trump fills out his cabinet with a bunch of generals, a doctor, a lawyer. How bad could they be? Then Pizzagate and the real-life horrors of fake-life news. Then is there any chance the Electoral College will reject Donald Trump? And is there any way to fix the Electoral College? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And for Slate Plus, the GabFest gift guide. We will pick our favorite objects, books, tools, presents of 2016. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. And the Slate Plus team tells us that you can give the gift of Slate Plus to another Slate fan in your life who will receive all the benefits of membership, such as ad-free podcasts, bonus podcast segments, and access to our Slate Academies. It's another way to support Slate's independent journalism. Give Slate Plus today at slate.com/giveplus. Donald Trump continues to fill up his cabinet. This week, he named Ben Carson, a neurosurgeon, as the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He is going to tap John Kelly, a general, to run the Homeland Security Department. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is his potential EPA administrator. James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, as Trump keeps telling us, a former Marine general, will be his Secretary of Defense if approved and passing a waiver. And, of course, Linda McMahon
of
World Wrestling Entertainment will be a small, will be the administrator of the Small Business Administration, which is just
that's
so
the contribution
funny.
From my home state of Connecticut. Yes, please
yes,
thank
Connecticut.
Us.
It's good to see Connecticut yeah. representing. She is not. She does not run a small business. She runs a huge business. But whatever. James Mattis, John. A lot of people who are very skeptical of Trump and dubious about his presidency have grabbed onto the Mattis news as like, oh, he's going to be the adult in the room. He's the warrior monk. He's a wise man. He's going to protect the republic. You have spent a great deal of time with Mattis. You've written about him a lot. So tell us about him and what. He represents as Secretary of Defense, potentially.
Right. So I spent a lot of time with Mattis, spent the night at his house and spent, you know, this is one of those kind of interviews where you could talk for several hours, then have dinner, talk for several more hours, have breakfast, talk for, it was, I say this because it's, I miss those kinds of interviews. So what I found compelling about him was the mix, and this was for the story that you edited or the series that you edited on Risk. One of the incendiary Mattis quotes that's out there is, be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet, which some people read and think, oh my God, this is a crazy man. But in that, I think in that quote, you see the kind of the balance of James Mattis, which is he is a Marine general. His primary job is to create plans for warfare. So that's what he does. But the other side of him, and the reason I was with him is because he was the co-creator with General Petraeus of the Counterinsurgency Manual, which is based on not going in and killing everybody. The exact opposite, taking off your Kevlar vest, taking off your sunglasses as you walk through the towns in Iraq to build connections with the towns, to stop rolling through with the tanks, to go and spend time trying to rebuild schools and rebuild trust and relationships so that you don't have to kill. He has this line about delay, first 1 minute, then 1 hour, then 1 day, then 1 month, then 1 year, the hostilities, because you want to do everything you can to avoid war. But then if you are faced with ultimately having to go to war, then have a plan to win decisively. That's him as a general. The challenge for him will be, those skills make him a warrior, not a Secretary of Defense. Now, he just wrote a book about the over-reliance on generals in the Obama administration and in the Bush administration. Really interesting. Basically saying, it's not the general's job to argue for war or argue for peace or argue for anything. Their job is to implement. It's the politician's job to make their case for why they should do what they're doing. And to muddy the waters is a bad idea. So Trump seems to be muddying the waters, so it'll be interesting to see how Mattis pushes back. He has built his career on pushing back against authority. He advocates, and one of the things that I found compelling in his argument for the systems you build as a general is he advocates for mavericks and people who push and cause trouble with their ideas. So we'll see if that's what he does in the Trump orbit.
So, Emily, John gets to one of the key points about Trump's appointment so far. Three generals already named to his top of the administration. Mattis, of course, General Michael Flynn, who's his national security advisor, and General John Kelly, who will run Homeland Security. General David Petraeus is apparently also under consideration for perhaps Secretary of State. Should we be alarmed that there are all these military men who are being tapped for such leadership positions? Obviously, when people say they're concerned about Trump's dictatorial tendencies, the fact that there are a lot of generals who are coming forth to lead key parts of the country, key parts of the government, may raise antennae.
Well, he has to get waivers for them, right? Because they're supposed to have been out of the government for 3 years before they come back in. And some of them, that's not true for. So there's kind of a built-in concern about having so much military influence at the top of the federal government. That said, Trump has made other choices that seem to be on the kind of extreme right wing. And these generals don't fit that description. one can hope that generals in these roles will be very conscious of their constitutional obligations and be a kind of steadying influence. I guess I feel like there are so many concerns swirling around this cabinet. This is not the one that is keeping me up at night
What is swirling? So you have, of course, Carson, who is appointed as HUD, who has no experience of any sort with anything like what HUD does, or as a senior administrator, who's very spokesman. Armstrong Williams, a man who I profiled for City Paper 25 years ago.
Awesome.
I would note that Armstrong had said basically that Carson shouldn't have a senior administrative role in the administration. And then Carson went and took this job. You have Pruitt appointed, who is the Oklahoma Attorney General, who's extremely anti-EPA, whose major activity relating to the EPA is suing them to try to prevent their regulations from going into effect, who will lead the EPA. What are your other concerns, Emily? What are your concerns that aren't that, oh, we have a bunch
of generals? Well, among the new set of choices for this week, yeah, I mean, so let's talk a little bit about HUD and the Fair Housing Act. So it was passed in 1968. It's the last of the big pieces of civil rights legislation to pass. And my colleague, Nicole Hannah-Jones, has an amazingly good piece in ProPublica about the history of how poorly and shoddily the Fair Housing Act has really been implemented over the decades. That started to change, honestly, in the Obama administration. One of the great pieces of history in Nicole's piece is that George Romney, who was the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development under Nixon, right after the Fair Housing Act change, he really tried to use it as a tool for desegregation. That's what the law has always stood for. It's always had this provision in it that the federal government has an obligation to, quote, affirmatively further fair housing and desegregation. Romney tried to put that into effect. Nixon wanted nothing to do with it, tried to get Romney to be the ambassador to China instead. Romney eventually quit in frustration. And ever since then, HUD has done some amount of trying to actually stop discrimination against African Americans and other minorities in housing, but really has not seen its role as ever blocking federal funds to cities and municipalities that are engaging in discrimination and where they place affordable housing units and how they rent using Section 8 vouchers. And so that there were new rules under the Obama administration to change some of that. And you look at what Carson has written about housing, which consists of one op-ed. I think it ran in the Washington Examiner or the Washington Times. And he just writes off any kind of efforts to address desegregation as what he calls, quote, social engineering, as if there's sort of this better default of just, you know, allowing white city officials to not give minorities real chances to live in other parts of the city, whether that's through redlining or whether it's by, you know, making sure that you segregate affordable houses in poor, mostly minority neighborhoods. Carson has expressed disinterest in changing any of that. That's the mandate of HUD. And so, you know, that's what we're going to see. And I've been talking too long to now launch into another monologue about Scott Pruitt. But you're right. He is completely pro fossil fuel industry. He submitted a letter to the EPA that was written by a big oil and gas company in Oklahoma. He just changed a couple words and put his signature on it. He didn't say that was where it had come from. He denied being a tool of industry. But I'm not sure what exactly else we're supposed to conclude about him. And like Donald Trump, he has professed a lot of doubt that climate change is caused by people and our human activity.
John, is this shaping up to be a cabinet that runs the administration?
Yeah.
Since the president-elect does not have any strong apparent interest in the kind of nitty-gritty of how things operate, is it going to be this cabinet that is going to play an enormous role in defining the Trump administration, which would be counter to a lot of what we've seen in recent years, where the cabinet has been weaker and weaker and weaker? Or will this be like it under George W. Bush, where really the White House runs everything and the cabinet is superficial?
This is a fantastic question, David, and it's one of the
thank you, John.
Really, really interesting things to watch. Since Donald Trump is a chaos person, which is to say he creates chaos because the destabilization allows him, as the creator of the chaos, who is comfortable in chaos, to then own the moment. We're going to have constant chaos from now all the way through, because that's one of his governing talents. I mean, it's going to make it even more important that everybody knows where to keep their eye on the ball. And with respect to his presidency, do you keep the eye on the White House or do you keep it on the agencies? Because what presidents, and I feel like it starts with Carter. Carter was a decentralizing president. He decided to give his cabinets all kinds of power and let them do what they wanted to do. They went off and did that. The problem was that a cabinet officer would go do something and then the White House would catch the hell for it. And so Carter decided, well, wait a minute, if we're going to get blamed for lack of message discipline and we're going to get blamed for everything all the agencies do, then we need to bring things inside the White House. So this is the political imperative that always creates the centralization of things within the White House. Trump doesn't really operate so much under those political rules. So in some cases, I think he's going to be happy to have it all outsourced to the agencies. On the other hand, he absolutely could kind of come crashing in saying, what the hell are you doing? So there could be these episodic moments of massive control. The administrator of Health and Human Services in the Affordable Care Act, but then in legislation in general, gets to make all kinds of decisions that a micromanaging White House might want to check off, but a White House not micromanaging would just allow to go by.
Right. And that person is Tom Price, right, who's wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act, who's right.
Although in that case, so does Trump. And you could see a situation, anyway, I guess the point is just pay attention to HHS and the EPA in a way we haven't before, because I think they'll be relatively autonomous, except again for these moments where there will be, you know, where Donald Trump will want to assert himself, take credit for something, you know, that he wants to meddle in. But he's not a details guy.
Can I just comment? I'm about to say something which is probably going to phrase in some way that's going to be horribly offensive. And
ooh, I'm excited.
No, it's not that. It's not interesting enough. But there's an appalling tokenism in the Carson appointment, right? So it's like the black guy. We're going to name the black guy to the black department. And then I was looking kind of across at how Trump has appointed people, and he's appointing to stereotype. Oh, HUD, that's the Department of Black People, so I'll appoint a black guy. His Treasury Secretary, no surprise at all, is a Jewish guy. Secretary of Defense, oh, we need a general. Secretary of State, he keeps talking about somebody who looks like a Secretary of State, which means they all look the part. The Secretary of Education is an old lady. Like, who's a teacher? It's like old ladies are teachers. Secretary of Commerce, it's an old billionaire dude. It's so I predict there will be the Secretary of Labor will be that's it where his Hispanic appointment will be, because like, oh, they work. That's what it is. They're just workers, the Hispanics. I guarantee you it seems to be how he thinks. One question which I'm curious about, Emily, is you have in Pruitt somebody who clearly does not like the EPA's mission as it is currently constituted. You have in Betsy DeVos, who's going to run the Department of Education, somebody who does not like the mission of the Department of Education. Ben Carson, as you pointed out, does not really have an interest in public housing or the mission of the Housing and Urban Development Department. Is the idea that you appoint these people so that they can change the mission or so that they can make this administration – is it to make the agency incompetent or to make it competent in a totally different way, which is antithetical to how it's been running?
I think you can.
Because I don't see what the administrator of the EPA does if he doesn't actually believe that the EPA should regulate.
You can change the mission and you can also agree to big budget cuts that starve the beast. I mean, who better to slash the budget of the EPA than Scott Pruitt, who doesn't think the EPA should regulate?
Right. So make it incompetence. So make the EPA worse
or
at its
just
job.
Not do its
not,
job.
Not change what it does.
Do its job. And then the other thing is there are important court cases coming up where you can change the government's position. The Obama administration has been defending the rule that it put out about the Clean Power Act that asks power plants to change what they're doing so that they're spewing less carbon dioxide, et cetera, into the air. You change that rule. And then maybe the court case over the Clean Power plant rule goes away. Change the position and then you starve the beast. That's what I would do if I were them.
That feels right on the EPA. I wonder if social engineering, that question and that word and that phrase will get thrown around a lot, and it gets used as a pejorative against the Obama administration. If you look at the person that is likely to administer the Medicaid program, the requirements for Medicaid and using health savings accounts, It's basically social engineering. In other words, it's trying to encourage better behavior. I mean, you know, basically on healthcare in particular, you try to get people to behave better, go do checkups, catch things early so their costs don't rise because when you treat them late, it's more expensive. So that is trying to encourage a kind of social behavior through policy. So it's inevitable that you're going to be end up doing some social engineering. So it's interesting sort of where the places of social engineering are and where and how they will work in a conservative, or I don't even know that we can call the Trump administration conservative in all ways. But anyway, that's one thing that interests me with respect to the Department of Education. So obviously on the healthcare front, it's interesting, but also to David's point about Betsy DeVos, I think she may be different than at EPA, which is she doesn't agree with what the Department of Education does now. But I think in the way that the Obama administration tried to use federal education money to encourage behaviors at the local level, I think she will try to do that. I think that the stuff that was claimed as social engineering in Obama's terms, I think they will try and do a version of their own social engineering. They will just do it with different goals in mind.
Right. Yeah. No, they'll do vouchers and charters. Everyone's
right.
Social engineering
is a meaningless term because it acts as if there's some default, which is not social engineering. When the government regulates, it channels people's behavior. When it doesn't regulate, it rechannels people's behavior. There is no other thing that government does.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Sunday afternoon at the Rosenplatz house in Northwest Washington, we were planning, as we often do, as probably the Dickersons often do, an afternoon quick trip up to Politics and Prose, do some book shopping, followed by a snack at Little Red Fox. Daughter is, as is her wont, is online checking Twitter and says there's an active shooter. So we don't go up to Politics and Prose because the local pizza parlor in very quiet, rich upper northwest neighborhood of Washington has been invaded by Edgar Madison Welch, who is a North Carolina man who was ultimately arrested on Sunday after he had driven up from North Carolina to perform a self-evaluation about whether the series of lies propagated by white nationalists and troublemakers and internet nutbags, lies designed to chaff the political system, whether they were true, whether that in fact there was a child sex ring orchestrated by high-level Democrats being conducted out of the non-existent basement in Comet Pizzeria, whether there were occult rituals and blood drinking taking place in this pizza place where my son had been at a birthday party 6 days earlier. The Welch's attack terrified and endangered customers, of course. It shut down a lot of DC for the afternoon. And it's a result of just some completely malicious propaganda fomented by malefactors. Some of the malefactors were merely gullible. Others of them are truly malicious. It was multiplied and magnified by lots of people, including the people in the Trump administration or the would-be people in the Trump administration. And it's totally confounding. Emily, what the hell can we do about this massive industry of lies and willing disbelief that has arisen in the last couple of years, that is born and lives primarily on the internet, but now can spill into real world experience all too easily.
Well, as consumers of information, we can all be careful and skeptical about what we believe and what kind of information we disseminate on social media. And then the overlords of social media, in particular Facebook, need to sit up straight and think about how they can have some responsibility here. You know, Mark Zuckerberg famously after the election didn't want to admit that Facebook had any responsibility for the spread of fake news and said that it had no impact on the election. It just seemed like he was totally abdicating his role. Since then, other folks at Facebook have been seeming to take this more seriously. And there are ways in which social media, and particular Facebook, in which everything you see is driven by an algorithm. Facebook can, without outright banning fake news or particular fake news sites, because Facebook doesn't want to take that step, Facebook can change the value it gives to certain platforms over others in what people see in their news feeds and what Facebook is promoting through its algorithm. But Facebook has to have human editors to make that work. And last summer, they got spooked by accusations that their human editors were biased against conservative media outlets. Didn't seem like it was really there was much to that allegation, but they got rid of all the human editors. And that has proved to be a huge problem. Facebook needs to take its editorial role in the world to heart and really admit that it's playing this massive function as the fire hose for news, the place where people are getting information. And without necessarily blocking people from sharing what they want to share, have some way of not presenting everything in this flattened same box that seems to give equal credibility to a post from, you know, CBS or CNN or Fox as it does to something from a made-up publication.
John, at the moment, this really only works on the right. The people who've studied this have said that the fake news is overwhelmingly a problem on the right, that it's people on the right who are sharing fake news, which stories that are critical and deplorable about things that the left is doing, that Hillary Clinton is doing, that Democrats are doing. Is the fact that this is really not bipartisan, that it's monopartisan, does that make it harder to stamp out?
I don't know. For me, what makes it hard to stamp out is, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out where to grab a hold of this complicated issue. Where the partisanship gets in here is a couple of things. One, the New York Times had a great piece about fake news this week in which they quote a guy from, I think, Minnesota, who basically says, it's like a hockey game. We have our goons, they have their goons. And this gets, I guess, to Tim Lee's tolerance point, which is, and his argument was, yeah, of course, this is all baloney, but, you know, to the extent that these stories get people I don't like all exercised and in a flutter, that's great, because we're in a big competition here. And yeah, it's not great that there's fighting in the hockey game, but I'm glad I have the guy who can beat up the other team because I don't like the other team. There's a cost to that. Now, the Comet pizza thing is a little weird because it's, you know, one crazy person who reads something will never be able to stamp that out.
Well, but now you can argue he's not the first person who showed up at Comet. He's the first person who showed up with a gun. There's another guy who'd shown up and was filming Comet.
And there was this and was stream filming of it. Harassment and there was people coming at this right. whole block.
And there's, yeah, the real world harassment of, yeah, just poisonous, vicious phone calls.
I also want to add in.
And not just for Comet, of the stores up and down that block. And the FBI, so it's not.
If only I could get out the next damn sentence.
Oh, come off.
So you don't want to criticize one person for a single act.
Wait,
the problem
you don't
with
want
Comet
to criticize one person.
Was,
for a single act when that act is going in and shooting someone?
Oh, come on. Jesus, come on. My point is you don't want to, criticize is the wrong word. Thank you for giving me the half an inch to try to describe it. The point is that one crazy person who goes off and does a crazy act, you want to recognize that that's not, you can't like throw the entire new set of rules around that. In this case, though, you have a story that had lots of different people following it. It galloped along and had lots of different, it affected lots of different people. So to dismiss it as a single person who just was one crazy person who saw some random story doesn't get at the idea that this had a much bigger following out there, and that just saying like, these are our goons beating up their goons, that there are costs. And this is possibly one of the costs. Where it gets into a partisan issue or a partisan tangle is conservatives will say, well, the story about Michael Brown saying, you know, don't shoot and putting his hands up was used as a rallying cry, created a condition of anger towards the police. That was a story that turned out to not be true. So what they would say is, well, that was fake news, too. And yet that wasn't disseminated by crazy news sites. That was discussed on mainstream news sites. And so in your conversation about fake news, you have people saying, well, the stories that were wrong and propagated by mainstream news, so why isn't that fake news too? Which obscures the obvious difference, which is, in one case, a story about a child sex ring in pizza has no connection with the natural, normal world that we live in and is completely crazy. Whereas in the Michael Brown case, while the hands up, don't shoot may not have happened, there was an instance in which a policeman shot a young man and there were confusing facts. And that's a little bit more close to the world we live in, as opposed to the Comet Pizza story, which is not only fiction, but like the most disturbed and baroque and weird fiction you can imagine.
I think it's also important to add that the Black Lives Matter movement was not simply about the shooting of Michael Brown, and that there were, as obviously we know and have talked about, several, many other shootings of unarmed Black people in which the facts did hold up exactly as they were initially reported that have fueled that movement. Right. Yeah. I mean, I know you're not making an exact equivalence here, but I think it's just important to make clear that the weight of evidence behind the Black Lives Matter movement is powerful. And that is not true for this fake news story we're talking about right now. At all.
Of course, as I just said. But the point is that when you're talking to people who are in a position to draw that equivalence, getting back to David's initial point, that's where the partisanship comes in. And being able to make very clear why the two are so wildly different, even though they share the fact that things were said that turned out not to be so, that thing that they share is such a small matter relative to the many other different ways in which they are totally not comparable. But if you are talking about partisanship and the way that partisans process this news stuff, there needs to be a way to explain that difference relatively quickly to people who are apt to use misreporting or incorrect reporting or the hurly-burly of a developing story as an excuse for why it's okay to have their own fake news because they see what the other side is doing as putting out fake news too.
Can I throw in one more, to me, I'm sure to you too, disturbing set of facts? This week, the FBI arrested someone who was issuing death threats to one of the parents of a child killed at the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. And the person issuing the death threats was, like the Comet Pizza shooter, inspired by wild, completely false conspiracy theories about how Sandy Hook was somehow made up or a hoax or a government plant. There is just something, I suppose, John, you might argue that two separate incidents don't make a pattern, but I do think we are seeing something dangerous here. And the fact that Michael Flynn and his son, Michael Flynn is still part of the Trump administration that will be coming in, and his son was had a role for at least some amount of time, being his father, to have these people not disavow these completely false, damaging, outrageous rumors that they help spread, that to me is tremendously dispiriting. And I deeply don't understand why that goes beyond partisanship.
You should note that these are from Alex Jones of InfoWars, who has said that Sandy Hoax is a hoax. And Alex Jones, who is a huge Trump supporter and who Trump has aligned
and praised
with
after the election and thanked.
But I think we have to remember that the tool, going back to John's point from the earlier segment, Trump is a chaos candidate. The tool that demagogues and dictators use is you churn up emotion, you churn up fake stories, you churn up anxiety and fear, and you create the swirl. It's a classic tool of how dictators and demagogues rule. And I don't think that Trump is himself the source of fake news stories. I don't think he is.
Don't excuse him. Millions of people voting illegally.
I'm not going to excuse him. But what I think he did, I think he does is that he has recognized to his tremendous advantage how much the sort of the anxiety and the fear and the anger and the emotion that he can work up over things benefits him. And what I would call for, what I want, what I seek, and I realize as I watch Obama's back as he walks off westward to whatever good future he deserves, is that one wonderful thing about Obama is that he governed in a very unemotional way for the most part, that he was a very calm, temperamentally calm kind of person. And the thing that we want to hope for, we want to normalize politics. We're in a state, and we have been largely because of Trump over the past 2 years, not entirely because of Trump, where everything has heightened emotion around politics. People feel much more strongly about it. They are kind of much more anxious and worked up and tense about it than the state of the economy, the state of their own lives, the state of the world would warrant. And that just makes people much more upset. And instead, people just need to channel this back into sports and into celebrity watching, that as long as people sort of are as energized about Trump and about what Trump is doing and about all the swirl around him, that Trumpism wins and that kind of frenzy wins. In some sense, the thing that we want is not, can't wish fake news away. You just want people to stop being as interested in news and just care a lot less and just be well, like, oh, get back to day to day. Because as long as they're sort of highly worked up over politics, that model is going to win. Don't go to the circus.
I don't think you mean care less. I think you mean, as I do, I'm going to now assume you agree with me, but with no evidence, that you want a slower, more...
Deliberative?
More discerning and deliberative and the same level of care. But it is, I think what you're describing is there. One of the problems with fake news is Trump plays on the outrage at the latest things he has done and that he's hoping they will bite. So that he'll get in a fight with the actors at Hamilton, or people will jump on his tweet about Boeing. Because obviously, David, you want people to care about all the underlying stuff they care about, just not to take the bait so easily.
Well, but I don't think any of the things that have been represented in these in the fake news actually matter at all. I don't think any of them, they shouldn't care about it. They shouldn't care about...
You mean like a crazy rumor with no evidence?
They should care when somebody shows up with a gun?
Well, no, they shouldn't care about the crazy rumors, Democratic occultism, or the just all that chaff. There's just 98% of what has been thrown out around what's been happening in American politics is just chaff. It's horrible chaff. Like, you should care that Medicare might be privatized, right? That's definitely a thing to care about. But you shouldn't be caring about every single frickin' little thing. I do think that we would be so much better served if, in fact, the overwhelming majority of Americans really stopped paying attention to politics and we just sort of let this is why you elect you have a republic where you elect people who represent you. So you elect them, they represent you, they carry forth legislation, that legislation is debated. And in fact, the more the populace is churned up constantly about this, the worse the government, the worse the country runs. The way that we focus on politics now is totally unproductive and poisonous. And so people shouldn't do it.
It seems like there's something really wise in what you're saying and something totally bogus at the same time. So yes, let's not get distracted.
That's the name. That's the title of my autobiography.
All right, yes,
Emily.
Let's not get distracted by all the chaff that is constantly being churned up by Trump and his people. Absolutely. But the notion that we don't want people to care about the workings of their government or the impact that government policies have, surely you're not arguing that? Come on. Like,
that's what I was trying to say.
I mean, David.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is if the choice is
that is constantly being frothed up by a
set of liars or a populace which pays no attention
ridiculous.
At all to what's being done
that's
by
a
the
total
government.
Straw man.
I think I would choose a populace that pays no attention.
I'm not really
Well, that's the point of straw man.
I just think that's I find that totally unsatisfying. I mean, one thing that we should be doing over the next 4 years is paying attention to the impact of the policies this administration puts into place. Not, you know, whether Donald Trump is having a meeting with Al Gore, who then gets suckered into making some like, oh, don't worry, statement. Everything's going to be great on climate change on the day of Scott Pruitt's nomination to head the EPA. But what the actual impact of these policies are on the real people who live in this country. That's what we need to pay attention to.
I totally agree. And that's my version of what David is saying, which is less alarm, more explaining, which is every piece that I read about Pruitt, it's like, oh, people are up in arms. And this environmental person says this is going to be terrible. And he's in the pocket of industry and blah. And it goes on for paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. I want stories that now start by saying, this person was chosen. Here are the five things that he could affect. And here are the five ways that will affect regular people. And here are the five next things to watch for the minute he gets keys to his office. Like, because what ends up happening is that the nine paragraphs of alarm just feel like the general sort of, it feels like chaff. It feels not that much different. They may be all totally wise desert fathers who know exactly the way this is all going to play out. But the quotes of alarm just sound like quotes of alarm. And we hear that from both sides. And it's like, oh, everybody's up in arms. More explaining, less being up in arms.
Would you include in that, John, the coverage that describes people's records? Because that does seem to me important. That's like evidence and facts.
You're totally right. No, I think past behavior is a predictor. So, and that's where when people say, you know, are worried about coverage of Donald Trump. I mean, past behavior and what they've done in the past and where the choices they've made and the choices that inform their decision making are crucial. That's the context for the job they're coming into. And it's a context for all their future decisions. And that's the way human beings work. You know, we build knowledge based on what we've decided and done in the past. So absolutely, the records are really important as long as people don't, you know, lean on the evidence. But for creating a context in which their statements on the job or their actions take place. No, I think you're exactly right. That's basically all we've got to go on until they start making decisions.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Although I'm going to not leave it there because I'm going to give myself one final word, which is the kind of people who are interested in the story you're talking about, John, are totally a different cohort than the kind of people who are fake news. The kind of people who are being fake news are people who yeah, okay. That's all I'm saying.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Democrats are tearing their hair out about the Electoral College, which will meet soon in various states to vote and ratify Donald Trump's election. The fretfulness is taking two forms. The first is, could electors be faithless enough to deny Donald Trump the presidency? The second is, the Electoral College is hideously biased, especially against Blue America, and it's a old-timey, archaic, completely broken non-representative system which denies equal representation to voters, unconstitutionally denies equal representation to voters, especially to voters who, as it turns out, are paying the most taxes and getting the least representation. Those of us who live in coastal cities are being especially deprived. So, Emily, let's talk about the two separate kind of legal questions here. One is the legal arguments about whether electors could be faithless. And the second is the legal arguments about whether the Electoral College itself is hopelessly flawed and is constitutionally flawed. So what are the legal arguments for being faithless as an elector? Is there anything that to prevent electors themselves from voting against the state, how their state voted?
Probably not, but we're not really sure because this has been so little tested. There's very little case law on it. I mean, it looks like the Electoral College can make its own decision. It has some kind of independent identity from the actual electorate. But we've never had an Electoral College that's refused as a body to follow the choices that it was tasked to follow by the voters. So we don't really know a whole lot about that. And to me, the second question you asked is the much more interesting substantive one, which is basically, why do we have this system that has led in this election and in other elections to the loser, in this case, by quite a large margin? We're getting close to, I think, 3 million more votes for Hillary Clinton in this context. And yet the loser of the popular vote contest will be president. The origins of the Electoral College, Akhil Amar at Yale Law School, makes a powerful argument that it was not a kind of big state versus small state mechanism, which I think is what a lot of us learned in high school. It really had to do with preserving slavery. It's like the Three-Fifths Clause. It gave Southern states a way to count their slaves as part of their population and have more political power as a result. Larry Lessig, another law professor, I think at Harvard, has been making an argument lately that the unconstitutional part of this is the winner-take-all aspect of it that almost all the states, except for Nebraska and Maine, follow. And so basically what Lessig is arguing is there's tension here between one person, one vote, and the way the Electoral College favors certain states heavily over other states. And it's really incredible how much that favoring is, right? I mean, we're talking about California having a population that's 66 times the population of Wyoming and getting 18 times the Electoral College votes. So Lessig says we can't do anything about the Electoral College setup itself without amending the Constitution. But you could have a court challenge about the winner-take-all mechanism that the states are allowing for. And that would be another way of changing the Electoral College. I'm not convinced by the argument that you could do that retroactively and affect the results of this past election, because we just had the election. Those were the rules. But going forward, one could imagine in theory this kind of challenge. And then the other thing is a whole bunch of states at the moment, unfortunately, all of them blue states, have signed on to this compact saying, we agree, we'll send our electors to the winner of the national popular vote once there are enough states with enough electoral votes signed up to make this a binding pledge. And that is like an easy way for the states to change the way power is allocated. The problem, of course, is that some states would be losers and they would have to agree that for the good of the polity and the democracy, we should make this change. So we'll see.
I love the National Popular Vote Interstate right. Compact, which you just described. I think it's so genius. It doesn't seem to require any constitutional change. It doesn't even seem to require any legislative action. The legal scholarship, undoubtedly, there would be a legal challenge to it. The idea being that states with representing 270 electoral votes sign on to this compact. They will agree to pool their electoral votes and supply them to whoever has won the popular vote, which means that, let's say, Ohio is one of the signatories to this compact and it has voted for a Republican in its own state, but a Democrat has won the popular vote, that Ohio would still assign its electoral college votes to the Democrat. So it would go against the state's own vote. Right now, there are 165 electoral votes represented by the states that have approved the compact. It's not entirely impossible that it gets enough electoral votes to go into effect, because the states that don't want it to go into effect are the purple states that are the tipping point states, which hold the balance of power. obviously very blue states want this to happen because it's a Democratic idea. But there are even some very red states which currently get no influence on the actual presidential election that would have an incentive to sign on to something like this, to have their votes suddenly start to matter in the election. A state like Texas, for example, a very red state that has a lot of people might want its votes, might want to be pandered to in a presidential election and might consider something like this. So, and it's past legislatures in red states. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that it could go somewhere.
Wouldn't that compact be undone if one of the states decided they didn't like the outcome in the way that people don't like the Donald Trump outcome?
That's a good question. You mean, could the electors in that state? So you have a state slate of electors who are elected in Ohio, and they're like, screw it. We voted for Republican. Why should we assign to a Democrat? Yeah, I think that the terms of the compact would have to be pretty strict, and it would have to have some sort of binding.
And like
force,
a lot of things in our system, it would have to be governed by norms and conventions in addition to or as opposed to law. I mean, that's something we're going to be talking about a lot in the next 4 years as norms shift and change and fall away. But that is one instance in which you can create a new agreement and people can follow it because they agreed to follow it.
I guess what I was saying, as I think about it, that compact seems to me the best chance for change, because I don't see a Republican Supreme Court. There's not going to be a constitutional amendment to overturn the Electoral College. And I also don't see a Republican Supreme Court accepting Larry Lessig's arguments about the unconstitutionality.
It's important to remember that, you know, crazy legal arguments like the equal protection argument that decided Bush versus Gore, sometimes they need to be aired, because sometimes they do carry the day, or that at least they seem to be less crazy once they're out there. So I wouldn't totally dismiss it. One more point, too, about having a national popular vote system that I think I also owe to Akhil Amar, which strikes me as really important, is that right now states have no incentive in this system to make it easier to vote. In other words, if you pay no penalty in the Electoral College if fewer of your people vote. You get the same number of electors, no matter what. By contrast, if we changed the system and it was all the national popular vote, you would have more political power, more sway over the future president as a state if more of your people voted, if you became a place where there was a huge amount of turnout. And when you think about the kind of separate partisan movement toward voter suppression and a way for making it easier to vote that's going on right now, this kind of change that we're talking about would be a counterforce that could actually be really important. Although I realize that this is all hypothetical.
That's a great point. Right. That's a great point. Yeah. I mean, all those poor people in California who vote.
It doesn't count.
Or in D.C. where I live. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we all, you know, whatever. I don't know what the vote count was in D.C., but I'm sure it was at least 80% to Clinton. Right. But each of those incremental votes made no difference.
And as we see more voter ID and more voter restrictions pass, you know, places like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, et cetera, they would have a disincentive to do those things as a state if having more people vote increased your authority.
I think, unfortunately, Emily, this is like a super long game.
I know.
If you're a Democrat and you want this is a very long game, because it's contingent on some set of Republicans deciding that also that the way the system works is not good for them. And right now, I don't think there's any Republican constituency that thinks that. I think that Republicans have decided, like, lower vote counts, increased power of small states, those are all things that benefit Republicans. And so that's going to persist for as long as
I mean, there was talk of the idea of Trump winning the popular vote and losing the Electoral College. And if that had happened, there might be kind of a bipartisan sense we need to change this. But of course, it didn't.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, New episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when you are pondering new ways to remake the Electoral College in your home, when you're sitting by the fire. We finally have a fireplace in my house. Hannah made me reopen our fireplace, so we may actually have a fire, which we will sit beside, Hannah and I and our children.
What did that require?
Well, it didn't require anything. It's just I hate fireplaces, and I resisted us using our fireplace. It doesn't draw very well. And
you hate them based on what?
Based on, do you want the true deep Plotzian psychology? I am a very competent person. I'm somebody who prides myself on my competence. Almost everything I do at like a B+ level. I'm a terrible maker of fires.
Oh.
And it embarrasses me. And because it embarrasses me, I've resisted it. And I've become an anti-fire person.
This can be remedied. This can be remedied. So
I know,
easily.
But it's very much about my own frailty and weakness and incompetence.
Yeah. I thought you were making an environmental claim against
David. I feel like John could show you how to make a good fire. You would catch onto it so quickly. It's totally something you would be good at.
You know what? The fact that you just said that, it's like, fuck you. Fuck you. It's like, what I really want is for my peer, John Dickerson, better paid peer, John Dickerson, to condescendingly come teach me how to make a fire. That would make me feel better.
So that every time you made a fire, it'd be like when you shave and you remember that guy who taught you how to shave.
Oh my God, we should be grateful to each other for these life lessons. You are not so anxious and insecure that you can't appreciate the help and guidance of a dear
excellent
friend.
Rebuttal.
Truly.
Are you done? How about giving us a cocktail chatter? How about a cocktail chatter
instead?
Oh,
my cocktail chatter is going to bring down the mood. I'm really sorry, but I can't let this week go by without expressing incredible dismay that the police officer who killed Walter Scott in North Carolina was not convicted this week. There was one holdout on this jury. This is a case in which we have a video of the police officer unloading and shooting someone in the back who was running away from him and then appearing to plant the gun next to Scott as he lay there dying. I can't stomach this result. There's going to be a retrial. Governor Nikki Haley, among many other people, called for that and said how important it was. Jelani Cobb has an interesting piece in The New Yorker about this result that I recommend reading. And we'll just have to see what happens next. But it just seemed like exactly the last sign we needed right now about American race relations to have this officer not face conviction.
John, what's your chatter?
My chatter is a wonderful interview that I saw with Andrew Wiles, who's a mathematician, and he's a legend for proving Fermat's last theorem, which is a problem that had been bedeviling mathematicians for centuries. And I don't even know what Fermat, I mean, I couldn't even possibly begin to explain Fermat's last theorem. But what I love about this interview is it's an interview in PLUS magazine, which is a magazine, an internet magazine, which is devoted to promoting the beauty and practical applications of mathematics. And in the interview, they ask him about what it was like to search for that proof for so long. And it's basically an interview about excitement and illumination that is found in a long private battle with a vexing problem. And most people would think of that as like total drudgery and doom, but the interview is like a pixie, absolutely alive with the fun of working this long problem. And he testifies to the faith that you need to have and hold to keep working at a long problem, and the kind of joy that he finds in that long pursuit. And the interview goes on and asks all kinds of interesting questions like, is mathematics discovered or invented? In other words, is it a natural law that we just come upon after long searching, or is it something that mankind has invented to order their world? But the other thing I liked about his interview is he talks about how to solve these big problems, you need to have a slightly bad memory because you need to forget the way you approached a problem the first time. If you do that little forgetting, then you put it aside and then approach it afresh in a way the next time, and that was one of the reasons or one of the ways he was able to solve this incredibly difficult problem. And then I guess the other thing that I loved about it was just that you learn to enjoy the process of uncertainty and of unsolvability and just be okay with that, not kind of, I mean, it's, I guess, what we learn about anything in sports. Most people learn it through sports anyway, which is that you just have to endure the training and the grueling part and just be okay with it. And he describes this moment or this process where when you achieve a certain level of mastery in that craft, you recognize that faced with a problem that seems impossible, you will find a way. You have a sufficient number of talents that, you know, you're going to get there. It's going to require a lot of work, but you will ultimately get there, that it's not insoluble. And I remember feeling that way with certain kinds of writing where I thought, oh, my, this is impossible. But then at some point feeling like, you know, like it'll work out somehow. Like I'll get there. I don't know how. It's going to be messy. I may need an editor to put me on the right path, but it's not something that I can't solve through simply the application of will and time. Anyway, so I encourage everybody, we'll put a link to the interview, and I encourage everybody to read it.
Three things. One, does he conclude whether it's invented or discovered?
He basically ducks. He basically says we're not philosophers, but he says, I don't know of a mathematician who doesn't think that it's discovered, which is to say, he believes that it's something that is discovered, not invented.
All right. Two, I love that idea that you need a bit of forgetting. Three, I was waiting to hear what Plus Magazine, there's so many different magazines that Plus could represent. It could be like the magazine for positive thinkers. It could be, I thought it was going to be like a magazine for plus size mathematicians. That was my other thinking. I didn't even know where you were going with it. It was exciting. It's a good name. Plus, a magazine for addenda. All right. That's a great chatter. So my chatter today is a double chatter. Just one very quick thing and one slightly longer thing. Slightly longer thing is there's a wonderful place in Williamstown, Vermont called Knight's Spiderweb Farm. It is run by an elderly couple. And what it is a farm where they have built frames that attract spiders. And these spiders come and they live there for a season and they build beautiful webs and then lay eggs, die, you know, Charlotte's Web it up. And Will Knight figured out a way to essentially preserve these spider webs as art, to paint them and turn them into decoration, turn them into their plaques, which have this beautiful whole web on them. They're gorgeous. I went there last summer. It's just a magical object that he's figured out how to create. The spiders are not killed, I would note, in the process of making this. They're not harmed in it. And it's just a crazy, weird thing he's invented. It's beautiful. It's strange. It's a natural wonder turned into a piece of human art. And the spiderweb farm, or much of the farm, burned down this fall. And they need funds to rebuild it. And I would just urge you to check out their GoFundMe page. GoFundMe.com/rebuild-the-spider-web-farm. Rebuild the spider web farm and give them some money. It's just a special place and deserves a long life. The other thing, which is something that John, I'm sure you know about, Emily, you probably do too, and I'm probably the last person to come to it. I finally heard the Johnny Cash Bridge Over Troubled Water, which he did very late in life with, I think, Fiona Apple maybe singing with him. And it's unbelievable. Mm. It is such a beautiful song.
Agreed.
If you guys haven't heard it, it is just out of sight. So Johnny Cash's Bridge Indeed. Over Troubled Water. Our interns, Kevin Townsend, our producers, Jocelyn Frank, Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcast. Andy Bowers is chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network. The entire roster of Panoply podcasts is at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @slategabfest, and our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes and leave a comment and rating. You can search for us in the iTunes store, Slate Political GabFest. For Emily Bazelon and John, the Firemaker Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Talk to you next week.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C., on Tuesday, May the 14th, my colleague Mark Joseph Stern and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.